former aide to Robert Kennedy, moratorium worker.
I want to make one brief announcement, and that is that I've just gotten a piece of literature which says that people interested in getting information about going to Washington, bus tickets and railroad tickets and times and places and prices, can make a phone call to 255-1075 or 255-0062. That's the Fifth Avenue Peace Parade Committee. Now, yes, I'll repeat the number, 255-1075 or 255-0062 for information about Washington. We have one final speaker. No, I won't repeat that number. I'll give you the piece of paper after it's over. Our final speaker is Andy Stapp of the American Servicemen's Union, and I think it's important that you hear him because he can bring you information about a movement which is remarkably widespread of dissent inside the military. But I'm going to have to ask you people over there to please be quiet because we're trying to have a program. You can go in the back room and fight to your heart's content, but not out here. And now, Andy Stapp of the American Servicemen's Union, and I thank him for waiting.
If Adam Walensky thinks that the greatest crisis that this country has entered since the Depression of the 1930s can be solved by electoral struggles or pseudo-struggles, which is what they really are, he's dead wrong. He's wrong. What happened in Cambodia is not just an escalation of the war. It's a qualitative jump. It's a spread of the war into all of Indochina. The GIs in the military know what this means. Now, 2 days ago, two companies, Alpha and Bravo Company, 3rd Battalion, 22nd Infantry and the 25th Division refused to go. They refused to go. And they had to be ordered gunpoint, facing 5 years for disobeying a direct order from an officer, the drumhead court marshals. They had to be ordered to go. Finally, 16 guys were the last remaining guys went. They were ambushed, Firebase Washington, and mauled. They knew what the spread of the war in Indochina would mean. Now what's this escalation? What's the whole context? What's it coming in the midst of? And why will it fail? It's coming in the background, the growing struggles, the liberation struggles, people all over the world, in Africa, the Arab people, in Latin America, and in Black America at home, and in China. This is something very important, something that the New York Times, with all its sophisticated prostitutes who write for it, didn't see fit to enlighten the American people about. And that's the connection between China putting up a satellite and the U.S. imperialist invasion of Cambodia. China is now a first-rate world power. They're a first-rate world power, much stronger than they were in Korea when they defeated all the puppets that the U.S. troops sent from 17 nations, much stronger even than they were in 1964. When they set off the first nuclear device in China. The U.S. is entered into a morass. This is what terrifies the McGoverns, Walenskys, the Lindsays. They know that they're not fighting, they're not just fighting the whole people of Indochina, they're fighting the whole third world, and they're panic-stricken. They feel that Nixon has gone mad. He's gone mad to do this. And the Soviet Union, for its own reasons, which aren't revolutionary reasons, will continue to aid these struggles to a certain extent. And they're afraid of that too. Now, they, like I said, they see it as a madness, the bourgeois liberals, an insanity, inexplicable. Why has the Mitchell and the Lindsay grouping done this? Why did they do it? It's irrational, they say. It's not sane. When we look back, we find that this policy that Nixon is now being accused of, and which he should be accused of, was formulated four presidents ago, went through Eisenhower, who's a moderate liberal, went through JFK, who was a flaming liberal, went through Lyndon, who was a Texas liberal, and he defeated a reactionary like himself. He was the lesser of two evils. And then it goes into Nixon, who's known as an out-and-out reactionary. So it doesn't seem to matter what the faces are in the White House, or even what they claim their politics to be. Everything from the New Frontier, the Great Society, to Nixon bringing us together. It's just the expansion of imperialist war and the intensification of a racist war against black people at home. Now the solution that the bourgeois liberals give through their organs like the New York Post, through their TV, is that we've got to have a new face. We've got to have a new face in the White House. We've got to have a new administration. But that's the daydream. That's not the realistic solution. And they don't want a solution because they're part of the imperialist system themselves. They feel this is a tactical question. The point is they're on the horns of a dilemma. Each way they turn, they're gored, because the reality of it is it's not Nixon who's irrational or Kennedy who is irrational, or it's not Eisenhower or Johnson who are irrational. It's capitalism that's irrational. That's what the problem is. And that these men who are evil, there's no question that Johnson and Nixon are evil men, but the real point is that they are puppets of forces beyond their control. Beyond their control.
WBAI, New York.
He pointed out a long time ago, he said Germany, meaning German capitalism, German industry, Germany has to expand or die. JFK called it trade or fade. Now, one was a fascist, one was a liberal. It's the same words. And what did Hitler do? He put this into practice. He had many victories at first, just as the U.S. imperialists had at the close of World War II. 20 years of expansion, 20 years where the dollar was as good as gold, and so forth.
You're tuned to WBAI, listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio in New York City at 99.5 FM. This is Paul Fisher, and in a few moments we'll be resuming our Winter Soldier investigation tapes. But before we do that, some of you may be wondering why some radio and television stations went off the air this morning, and according to UPI, here is the answer. It's regular afternoon programming until 5 p.m. to broadcast the conclusion of the Winter Soldier investigation. On Saturday, February 6th and Sunday, February 7th, WBAI presented some 18 hours of the Winter Soldier investigation, but was unable to conclude it at that time because of a power blackout in Manhattan that knocked us off the air, so we will conclude it this afternoon. The Winter Soldier investigation was held in Detroit, Michigan from Sunday, January 31st through Tuesday, February 2nd, and was held under the auspices of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. During those 3 days, more than 100 veterans of the war in Vietnam, from units ranging from the AmeriCal Division to the Green Berets, from military intelligence officers to military information officers, testified about atrocities in Vietnam, atrocities that they personally witnessed, and in some instances, atrocities that they themselves committed. Despite the import of the event, the Winter Soldier investigation received little attention from the media, and that's one of the reasons why WBAI has been presenting this GI testimony in full. Each GI that testified carried some form of proof with them. All of them presented their military discharge papers to the press, detailing their ranks and where they had served and what training they received. Others brought color slides of atrocities, and one presented a SATCOM badge, a badge received upon the presentation of an ear from a dead member of the opposition. If all goes according to plan, two of the participants in the Winter Soldier investigation, Scott Camille, a former member of the 1st Marine Division, and Sergeant Mike McCusker, will be here at about 4 p.m., and if they're amenable to the idea, we'll take some telephone calls on the air and find out more about them and the Winter Soldier investigation. Camille and McCusker were both heard on earlier segments of the Winter Soldier investigation. Among other things, Camille testified to witnessing an officer skinning a suspect alive. McCusker was an information officer attached to the Marines, and he testified about suppression of news in Vietnam, both military and civilian news. They will probably be here at about 4 this afternoon, so until then, we'll broadcast the actual tapes of the Winter Soldier investigation, picking up from where we left off during the power blackout 2 Sundays ago. The panel you will hear in just a moment included GIs from the 1st, 4th, and 9th Infantry Divisions.
Phil, we would have to pull bunker guard in the daytime to get out of details, and on these kids would come into the dump and around the berm and try to take cans and anything that they could use. And they issued us M79s with CS gas. And it was, they had told us, like, to shoot close to them. And we'd shoot maybe around 8 or 9 rounds of M79 CS, chasing them all the way back to the wood line. And we wouldn't be aiming close to them. We'd be aiming right at them. And I think this is the way most of the dumps were, to keep the children and mamasans away from it. I mean, there was many methods used to do this.
We did the same thing in 239. In fact, I've participated in that myself, shooting at kids and civilians in garbage dumps with the M79. Well, you remember, Mark, when that happened. And a few other things which I saw, brutalization of civilians. We were on an S&D search and destroy mission one time outside of Rakhine early in 68. We were coming about, we're about, I'd say, 2 miles outside of Rakhine, and all of a sudden a water buffalo charged the point, and the guy machine gunned the water buffalo, and it so happened that an Arvin squad was in front of us, and they thought they were being ambushed. They hadn't seen us, and so they started firing at us, and a small firefight broke out. Well, in the middle of the firefight, the firefight stopped after a few minutes, and a civilian was hit, as I remember, in the chest. So we came. He was on a bicycle when he was hit, and we had about 2 clicks to go back to Rakhine. And so instead of calling in a dust off, we just threw him over the bicycle. He was still alive, and he went back that way on the bicycle. Bleeding. I don't know what happened to him. I think he died, but I don't know.
Scott, I think this might fit in here. You were talking to me before about inflated med cap counts. Could you explain exactly what a med cap is and explain how the inflated count would harm the civilians?
Yeah, a med cap is an idea. It's supposedly treating the Vietnamese civilians for wounds received by H&I fires or diseases they had, or things along this line. I should first explain that in the 9th Division, there was a tremendous competition amongst the colonels, not only in this particular area, which we'll be talking about, but also body count and combat effectiveness, which we talked about before. Pressure was put on me as a platoon leader to make sure I got a lot of people out into the field, and they didn't care how I got them out there. And if I didn't get them out, all sorts of things were threatened. So I sent men out, you know, who had jungle rot and this sort of thing. The battalion doctor, pressure was put on him as a matter of fact, everything had to be approved by the major, the executive officer. And if the battalion doctor had too many people on sick call, pressure was put on him. So it was a circle. I think Mark can get into the MedCap program. He was on more MedCaps than I was.
Well, the MedCap program was supposed to be part of the pacification plan that the United States was to carry out in Vietnam. And it was trying to win the people, of course, by being nice to them and going in and treating them. Well, the MedCaps that I participated in, Scott was more or less logistical after he was off the line. Myself, I was still on the line as a combat troop. And we'd go in to give the doctors and his team of people security. Well, when you go into a village for a MedCap, you really didn't need the security because anybody who was there wasn't going to mess with you because they knew you were bringing them good things. But the thing is, the people didn't get treated. Not like they say. You'd have MedCaps where you'd go in and there'd be 10 people, and out of the 10 people, you'd give away 10 bars of soap and 3 candy bars. And then you'd go back to the battalion, and the colonel would want to know, well, how'd we do on the MedCap today, boys? We treat a lot of people. So, sure, we treated a lot of people, sir. We had 50 people, man. We had a lot of bad feet. We treated a lot of bad feet. And we treated a lot of little babies were sick, man. We gave a lot of injections, and you did nothing. Threw soap out, man, and then everybody sat down and ate bananas and ripped off the people. And then you'd leave, and that was a pacification program. So no matter what you hear, it's not the truth.
Mark or Scott, who's ever got the microphone now, what was the attitude of the medical personnel towards the civilians while on a MedCap?
Well, I guess Mark pointed out they didn't really care. Some of them did, depending on the individual, but the general attitude was to get as many people treated so it would look good in the MedCap chart, which they had. The colonel, I was with the 2nd or 39th, the other battalions were competing to see who could treat more people. And I remember the S5 officer standing up at briefings and saying, well, he treated, say, 60 people, and the colonel saying, well, the two, 2nd and the 60th treated 85. Let's get the count up. So he'd go back and sometimes read Playboy magazine and then and come back and report 85. Sometimes they never got treated, so.
Okay, just got a very quick announcement here. There's a future planning meeting for vets being held in the vets room right now. So any vets in here, please go in there. Bob, you told me about an incident where a little kid was killed. Could you go into that in more detail?
When I was out in the field outside of Lock K and with the infantry, we're a move up north, so some of us had to go by slicks, which are helicopters, and some by trucks or jeeps to Quan Loi to resupply the people who left previous before us. On the way up to Quan Loi, we're on Highway 13, and usually you go through villages and you see little kids with their hands out, you know, begging. Well, at first I saw GIs tossing the cans out to them, sea ration cans. Then all of a sudden I saw they were coming pretty fast at the children, and I saw two or three of them killed like they were stoned with sea ration cans. And we were stopped by the MPs, and he just warned us, so we just kept on with our convoy, and nothing was said about the kids.
Were there any officers present?
Yes, there was a first lieutenant present when we were going to Quan Loi.
Did he say anything?
No, he just looked away and just kept on walking towards his jeep when the MPs were talking to us.
Okay, and besides the MPs' warning, was any other action taken?
No, there wasn't.
Okay. Yes, John?
There was a a certain craziness among the people in Vietnam when they were in Vietnam. When I was there, they used to take our company on a convoy, and you'd be on Deuce-and-a-halfs, the back of Deuce-and-a-halfs, and you'd throw smoke bombs into buses, and all the people would be running. There are a lot of games you play with the people. The army kind of fosters this gaming. Go out on a patrol, and most houses have shrines, Buddhist shrines, and you can go in and rip off knickknacks to send home, you know, if you've got somebody home who wants something like that. I've got some Buddhist prayer beads at home that I saw ripped off by another guy who gave them to me, and I tried to give them back to a Buddhist, but I'm afraid you don't do things like that.
Scott and Mark, I just want to ask you, since you both were officers, what was the general, and I guess you were a lot closer to the other officers than a lot of EM get, what was the general attitude of the officers during these incidents? You know, were you shocked? Did you do anything? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I'll take that. I think it was a matter of myself. The training I had received, I went through officer candidate school at Benning, then I was a tactical officer after that, and I was gung-ho, and just in a weird mentality. I mean, I think back on it, it's difficult to believe I thought like that once, but like, to me, at that time, there was no humaneness. I these people were subhuman, and well, they were, the expression used was gooks, and it wasn't like you were, well, it was just an inhumane attitude in general. So usually, at least the way I saw it, nothing was said very much about it.
To go along with what Scott said and with the mistreatment of civilians and personnel that happened all the time, and nothing was said about it, was like you said, I was also an officer, and if it was to be reported, apparently it would be reported by myself. But my attitude at that time was such that they were subhumans, and it didn't make any difference what happened to them, because I didn't want to be there anyway, man. I just wanted to get home and get it over with. And if I would make it a little easier for me, well then, I'd make it easier on myself. I have an incident I'd like to relate. On the first operation that I was on in country, we went into a village called Five Fingers. And it was a typical cordon and search, which is you surround a village and then you sweep through it. And hopefully, when you're sweeping, if anybody's running from you, they're going to run into the, of course, the surrounding troops on the other side, and then they get wiped out. But we received fire as we walked into the village, and we took no casualties, but we did end up with a body count. No weapons were found, so apparently they were civilians. The next day, in the morning, should I say, they rounded up the entire village, all of them, and marched them out. You were all prisoners of war, all of them. Men, women, children, made no difference. We filled 2 deuce-and-a-halves. They had to walk like maybe 5,000 meters to the vehicles, and then from the vehicles they were, you know, transported to our forward base where they were interrogated, and then they were just relocated, man, just moved away.
The next day we went back into the village and we were to finish it off. And there was burning and things going on. And one of the things that was picked up were there were two Hondas that were confiscated by the troops. And as these were confiscated, one was sold on the road immediately to another civilian who just happened to be passing by, and the guy, you know, turned the motorcycle into Vietnamese piastres. So he had ready cash. The other one was taken down the road a short way and was repaired at a Honda repair shop, and then was just taken with the troops and they used it at the base. Not only were they confiscated, but the part that was bad is it was reported on the battalion board as a VC platoon, a VC transportation platoon that had been captured. And then, of course, the colonel, you know, brought this up when he would be with his contemporaries, his, you know, people of his same rank. Yeah, well, my battalion got a VC transportation platoon yesterday, man. We got it on the board. Look, didn't that look nice? And yeah. What happened was we ripped off two motorcycles.
You say when these people are relocated, they were put into deuce and a halves, they were taken for interrogation. Were they allowed to take any of their belongings with them?
Well, when you round them up right now, and they don't go back for belongings because you don't know what they're going back for. At least that's the way my thinking was then. So when they left with what they had on.
In other words, all of their belongings were left in the village.
Right, and then the
destroyed.
Next day, like I say, we went through the village and tore everything apart. You know, tore walls out of hooches, just ripped everything apart looking for weapons or whatever. But we found nothing, and then they just, you know, set a torch to whatever you wanted to burn.
Mike, would you like to speak?
Like the brutalizing effect is on people, you know, that war has and that the army helps to foster. This is not a direct order. This is what our platoon sergeant told us, you know, in conversation with the platoon. As far as treatments upon people, when you come upon them as, you know, search and destroy mission, he says, if there's a woman in a hooch, and I'm going to, you know, gentle down the language, I'm not going to say it the way he said it. He says, if there's a woman in the hooch, lift up her dress, you know, and tell by her sex, if it's a male, kill him, and if it's a female, rape her, you know. Like, this man, this was his third war, you know. He's rather proud of the fact that he was in his third war. Served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And, like, I think, you know, but this is just a personal opinion of this man. He had irrational conduct because we were slightly rebellious to all the work we had to do, plus the ambush patrols we had to go at night. And there was a lot of complaining. So this is in a forward area, and I'm sure these other people can concur with it. This village of Anyutan, we're out there in close march drill in Vietnam as punishment. Now, this was his punishment to us because we were grumbling and we weren't there quick enough. Standing at attention in the war zone, we're in that same village sitting where we were marching, we got fired upon. I mean, there's several, I can just go on and on and on. Every time everybody says something, you know, brings to mind something else. But, like, they're talking about, like, body counts, too. Now, they would say, you know, a spotter pilot saw the spotter pilot's one of these little planes that flies around for the artillery. It's
like a Piper Cub.
It's like a Piper Cub. It's a single-engine plane, and its top speed's about 90, 100 miles an hour. And they say that these spotter planes, they'd also call in the jets, and they'd, you know, monitor where the jets were dropping the bombs, and they'd get body counts from them. They'd say they'd see pieces of arms and bodies flying in the air, and then they'd get a body count off of that. Now, here's a man flying around 100 feet, 200 feet, 300 feet in the air, and he's counting bodies that is reported back to the news. You know, I mean, really, it's a joke. I myself really never had anything that I could, you know, satisfactorily call a body count, you know, from the effect of our company sweeping through an area and really killing somebody.
By the way, Mike, earlier we were talking to John Henry there about the dumps. I believe that you mentioned to me that you had seen a child on the dump who was permanently lamed. Could you go into that a bit?
Well, like on the dumps, we threw CS gas at them. And this was down in our battalion base camp, and like we were in a bunker during the day. We weren't out in the field, and this one sergeant, he was in S4. S4 is the supply section. He said that, you know, if any of them gooks come over by the garbage dump to fire over their heads. So, like, I didn't do it. The fellow I was with was firing over their heads. He fired over a couple children's heads. And another time I was on a sick call, and there was a young child, Vietnamese child in there. I'd say he's school age, you know, early school age, about 6, 7. And he had a mutilated limb. I really don't remember which, you know, his arm or leg, but he was hit by a bullet, you know, from an M16. And I asked the medic that was used to be attached to our company and go out in the field with us what happened to that child. And he said he was down at the dump, and he was hit. A sergeant shot at him, you know, chasing him away, and he hit him. And I asked him, did anything come of it? And he said no.
Okay, Bill Rice, you've been dying to say something.
Yeah, right. I think the whole thing, you tie a lot of these things in on the psychology used, especially in the 9th Division. They tell us, in line with the dump and things, they tell us that